You've been sued, now what? If you don't have asset protection strategies in place, you could be a sitting duck for lawsuits. But even if you do, you could still potentially be hit with litigation that threatens your wealth. Learn from how the super rich solve their lawsuit problems on today's podcast as we discuss how you can tap into the same resources they use. All of this and more on Let's Make Work Optional.
Welcome to this episode of Let's Make Work Optional with True Wealth & Company in Overland Park, Kansas. True Wealth & Company incorporates strategies and products of the super rich to help you reach your financial goals and make work optional. We utilize elite wealth planning methods to help manage life solutions. We strive to help you maximize and achieve all that's important to you, which includes taking care of the people you love, helping the causes that are important to you, and making a difference in the world. Learn how to apply the habits of the super rich and gain insight on how they acquired their wealth in this episode of Let's Make Work Optional. And now, here's Brian Sarf, President and CEO of True Wealth & Company.
Welcome to Let's Make Work Optional. I'm Brian Sarf. We're here every Tuesday at 5 a.m., and I hope you are too. You can find the Let's Make Work Optional podcast on iTunes, Anchor.fm, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. On today's show, I am joined by Matt Geiger with Geiger Prell. He's a business trial attorney. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you, Brian. I am delighted to be here and delighted to see yet another of your many talents.
Thank you. I've been itching and been very excited to have you in the studio because your wealth of knowledge and what you do for the specific cases when business owners need you. You're a great person to know, and I wanted to introduce you to our listening audience and share some of these asset protection strategies to keep people's nose out of hot water. Business owners are easy to step in it and make a lot of problems for themselves that there are ways they can avoid that.
It's my pleasure to be here. And business owners work so hard for their money and so hard to build wealth over a lifetime. And to have it taken away through a very uncertain legal system is terrifying for some people. And so I hope I can answer some questions and maybe remove some of the fear of the process.
Yeah, it'd be great. Thank you. So the key takeaways from today's show are asset protection strategies don't always guarantee that your wealth is secure. Number two, litigation problem solvers and savvy attorneys can be instrumental in negotiating a solution if you're sued. And number three, asset protection plans should be revisited regularly, especially if you're involved in a lawsuit that threatens your wealth. So the United States is a pretty litigious country, might be the most litigious in the world, and people are going to get sued, especially the more wealth you have, the more visible you are, the more people you interact with, the more things that you do, you have that target on your back. How do you help your clients avoid the target?
I have some clients who believe the number of times they've been sued is their measure of success in business.
Yes.
So some of them come in with a different attitude. But the fact of the matter is there's nothing to prevent a person from being sued. All it takes is a filing fee and the will to file the lawsuit. I've seen lawsuits against God. I've seen lawsuits against the president. I've seen lawsuits against Moses, historical figures, a number, a lawsuit, a mathematical equation. The kinds of lawsuits that get filed are insane. And there's not a way to get rid of any of them quickly unless it's a very specific claim and there's a very specific legal defense. And so I tell my clients, be ready for a long battle. It's like dating someone. You're either going to break up or you're going to get married. When you are sued, you are either going to go to trial or you are going to settle the case. There is no other way that it ends.
I know that with the business owners I work with and the individuals I work with, that we talk a lot about getting everything in place as soon as possible so that we tidy up all the loose ends, because you have to have your protection strategies in place before you get sued, not after. Can you talk about why that is? Why you can't, if I get sued, then I can go do my asset protection strategies later to hide my money or to title everything a certain way?
Sure. So the law is not going to allow a person to protect assets reactively to a claim or a liability. So once you know the liability exists, it's too late for you to protect your assets, except for certain exemptions. Some folks don't know this, but there is some property that is protected. In Kansas, for example, you have a homestead exemption that protects your home and the 1 acre surrounding it from being seized by a judgment creditor. Now, there are exceptions for the government, exceptions to the exceptions, right? I've been on your show for 3 minutes, and I'm already talking about exceptions to exceptions. I apologize.
Is there a dollar limit on the homestead exemption?
There's not. It's a geographic limit, and it's 160 rural acres or 1 acre and your home within a incorporated town or city in Kansas. And so you've got a homestead exemption. Your children's 529 plan can't be seized by a judgment creditor. Your car up to $20,000 value can't be seized by a judgment creditor.
What about IRAs, Roth IRAs, 401ks, and those things?
Depends. That is a case by case, and you would want to talk to your lawyer specifically about your qualified plan and where it fits in. But a lot of those are protected too. I've been on both sides of this. I've been on the collection side representing plaintiffs, and I've been on the defense side representing folks who have judgments against them. You've got to identify your risk at the front end, identify the assets that are not exempt, get them into a trust, get them into a limited liability company, and then you're ready when the rains come. Your ship's built.
Some people are afraid to talk to a lawyer, to call a lawyer, or to, you know, they think it's the end of the world if they get sued or something happens to them. And really, all we're looking at, and I love this terminology, that you're a litigation problem solver. And we want to try and solve the problems before they become an issue, but sometimes we can't. You're not scary people. We're fine here in the room. I mean, we have a cage between us, you know.
Well, sure.
You know, but it's wonderful to know attorneys. It's great to talk with somebody, to sit down and just to visit with you, to get to know you and to talk about your situation on how they can protect themselves before they get into trouble.
Yeah, Brian, that's absolutely right. It's building those relationships just like you have a relationship with your accountant. With your doctor, you should have a relationship with a lawyer that can give you tips on how to position yourself, how to identify your risk. It's no different than shopping for insurance. You have to know where your risks in your business are, where the holes are, and how to protect yourself. If and when that day comes and you are sued, you already want to have somebody there that you can pick up the phone and call and see that day. You don't want to be distracted looking for a lawyer who does what you need when you have the problem. You want to have that relationship before. That's why when you send me somebody, Brian, I'll talk to him for a half hour and not send him a bill.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that.
And that's what people should expect. The legal profession's become very inaccessible to ordinary Americans. It's hard to sit down with a lawyer. And if a lawyer won't talk to you for 30 minutes, you need to find another lawyer. Nobody should be sending a bill for 30 minutes a time.
Well, the other portion should be you want to know they're connected, that they have a network. Just like being a financial advisor, I don't know all of the ins and outs of the legal world if I have a business dispute. But I know that you do, and I know to call Matt Geiger if that happens. But we want to know that Matt Geiger knows his world that he's great in, but if you have many of the other types of lawsuits you can have or legal issues, that may not be in your wheelhouse, but you know who to dial up, who to call. And having that network, having known you and know who your network is, your network's extensive. And we have a lot of people that if they come to you and they need to bring another person to the table, or to refer somebody out that it's not in your wheelhouse, that you have a great network. And I really appreciate that you've taken the time to build a great network amongst the legal community here in town.
And same to you, Brian, with your network globally. My network is pretty localized in Kansas City, but I have good relationships in Kansas City, and I know what I do well. I represent business owners, I represent executives, and I protect their money. That's what I do. I go get it when somebody takes it, and I defend it when somebody wants it. But if you get in a car accident and you need to know who to call. I can give you the names. I can send you to other people. I can tell you, you don't need an electrician. You need a plumber for this problem.
If I get a lawsuit and I'm sued, what's the process look like? What's the litigation process that you're going to walk somebody through, and what should they be expecting?
When somebody walks in my office with a lawsuit, the first thing we're going to talk about is what happened. And there's three parts to every case. There's the liability side, which is the story. What was done wrong that the lawsuit is about? What's the movie if it's a movie?
Mm-hmm.
The next part is damages. How much harm was caused by it? And the last part is collectability. If the plaintiff wins, is the plaintiff going to be able to get anything at the end of the day? And the asset protection we're talking about really zeroes in on that third piece. Clients want to talk about the first piece. They want to tell the story. They want to let you know how they've been wronged. And so I listen. First hour, I listen, because I am not going to be able to convey any useful information until the client has told me their story. And so the first hour is really listening. when I feel that the client has emoted, has had that catharsis of telling the story, then we start talking about strategy. The procedure is pretty basic. Lawsuit's filed. You file an answer within 21 to 30 days, depending on what jurisdiction you're in, and you build a legal and factual defense. You take discovery, you get into depositions, you gather the evidence you need to try your case, and then you go to trial. And the biggest piece of advice I can give someone hiring a lawyer for the first time in a business dispute, you have to ask whether they've been to trial and the last time they've been. There are hundreds of lawyers who hold themselves out to be business litigators. Ask them, how many cases have you tried to verdict? What courts? Where? What were they about? Did you win? Those are all important questions.
How about for you?
I'm 20 plus in terms of trials that I've had in my career. My biggest verdict was $14.5 million in federal court in 2000 on a handshake agreement.
Wow. What was that like?
It was incredible. It was an incredible experience. The only experience more incredible was some of the federal criminal defense I did for the first two or three years of my career. Hearing not guilty is an incredible sensation. Hearing guilty is an equally difficult sensation, and those highs and lows were not for me. I got great experience in the courtroom. I got great trial work, but winning a case that size in federal court changes your risk tolerance. You're no longer afraid to lose. You've got that big win, and so you can be yourself.
That's important to be yourself.
It is.
Especially with you're getting to know your client, having confidence in the counseling you're giving them, and knowing what the process to be expected down the line as you kind of put your story together and figure out your damages to figure out that settlement. Now, with damages, what do damages look like? Explain what damages mean, because that means different things to different people.
Sure. So your lawsuit is your story and it's what's happened to you. But if you haven't been harmed financially, there's nothing the judge can do to help you.
In a business dispute.
In a business dispute. So let's say that someone interferes with your business and you don't lose any profits. There's illegal interference with your business. You don't lose profits. And in fact, your business gets better during the time this tortious conduct or this illegal conduct occurs. At the end of that case, the judge will say, Mr. Geiger, I agree that your client has been wronged, but what do you want me to give him? And a lot of clients believe I can just say $1 million. Like I can just pull that number out and you get $1 million.
What do they call it? Punitive or for pain and suffering, whatever those types of disputes are.
In my world, in business cases, we have accountants that are calculating damages, testifying about lost profits, doing economic analysis. It is a very mathematical, scientific process to prove your damages. Because if your business has lost money, you have to prove that it's because of the defendant, mm-hmm. not because of the market, not because of other factors. And sometimes that's the most difficult part of the case, and that's where the battle's won or lost, and a lot of work goes into proving damages.
So let's say we get through, and you get through and you assess and you realize that you've got two outcomes. You're either going to have litigation where you're going to go to trial, or you can have an agreement. As you come through that, there are different types of agreements. The two people in dispute may just agree to disagree and come to a dollar settlement and it's over. Sometimes you have to go through mediation. Sometimes you have to go through arbitration. Talk about those three different types of getting an agreement without having to actually go to trial and what those mean and how binding they are.
Sure. So arbitration is just a substitute for the legal process. You can go down to Johnson County District Court and pay a filing fee of less than $200 and the judge will hear your case and decide it for free. Or you can go to AAA, the arbitration panel, and you can pay three lawyers $500 an hour each to do what the judge will do for your tax dollars. So you might be able to guess my overall view on arbitration. I think it's a...
Sounds like you're against it.
I think it's a racket and a waste of money.
Okay, that's pretty plain and clear.
No problem saying it.
Yes.
I think the judges that we have in Kansas City are smart, hardworking, well-educated lawyers who know how to reach conclusions and make decisions. When you go to an arbitration panel, you are hiring regular private practicing lawyers to do that job that the judges have been trained to do.
Is arbitration binding?
It is, and there's no appeals. If the judge makes a mistake, down here in Johnson County District Court, you go to the Kansas Court of Appeals.
That's a big risk.
It's a huge risk.
So what about mediation? What does that look like?
Mediation is non-binding. So mediation is the parties coming together in an office with a third-party neutral, usually a lawyer or a retired judge.
So I'd be in a room with my attorney, the other person would be in a room with their attorney, and then you'd have an uninterested third party that's just trying to come to a settlement.
That's correct. And the mediator is trying to show both sides what's wrong with their case.
Okay.
To try to bring them to a number in the middle. There's a lot of good mediators in Kansas City. The process only works if both sides are committed to resolving the case. If one side is not going to resolve the case, it's a waste of time and money. So I tell my clients, don't mediate until you know that both sides are ready. And sometimes you have to go take the other side's deposition and let them know what trial is going to be like.
How long does it take? If I'm sued today, let's say I get a paper in the mail, you know, that I've been sued. How long typically is it until I'm actually in the courtroom defending the lawsuit in front of the judge to come to a settlement? What's that time frame on that? Is that months? Is that quarters? Is that over a year or so? What's the time frame look like?
Most of the cases in the Kansas City area are getting to trial in 18 months to 2 years. That's a normal time frame. But in terms of the actual litigants coming to court, the parties, they may not show up until trial. The lawyers have to show up.
Sure.
But the parties sometimes don't show up until trial. Usually the first big event in the lawsuit for the client is the deposition. They are giving sworn testimony under oath. A court reporter's there taking down the answers that they give to the lawyer's questions. And discovery's very broad. Sometimes it gets into some private areas in their life. And so that's the big event that really makes people think about settlement. But I will tell you, the depositions are not as scary as they seem. And I think our firm is as good as any in the city, maybe the Midwest, at preparing people to testify.
And how do you prepare them to testify?
Over several sessions.
Lots of questions.
But I can't give away that secret sauce.
But you want to make them uncomfortable. You want to ask the tough questions so they can process them, because sometimes just knowing the question that may come out can help you prepare to answer it, and then to help them answering that question, I think, would be important.
I'll give you this teaser. There's three sessions, and we've done it the same way for more than a decade. The first session is, what are you worried about? What are you afraid of? It's to allow the client, very much like the first meeting, to come in and get their fears off their chest.
Okay.
And it's a lot of listening.
Yes.
The second session is about the case, the key issues in the case, the themes of the case, the things that we want to develop. Sometimes clients think parts of their story are really important because they're really important to them, but that doesn't mean they're really important to the case. And so that second session is talking about what's important in the case.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third session is what you were talking about. It's the dress rehearsal, as bad as it can be and as tough as it can be. And if after those three sessions, a client comes out of a deposition and tells me, Matt, I was surprised by this question, then I have not done my job.
So you don't want any surprises?
No surprises.
When you go through. So the first part of this is you have to do an internal assessment of understanding what's going on. Then I would think the second part of it is we have to do an external assessment of who's suing you. Why are they suing you? And what do we know about them?
And their lawyer.
What their financial, do they have deep pockets? Are they broke? Who's their community they run around with? What are their bad habits? How much do you know about them that probably helps you prepare, I would think?
Figuring out what motivates your adversary is the key to winning any war, including litigation. And sometimes it's not about money. Sometimes there's a business solution that is less expensive than either the litigation or paying a settlement. And you've got to really explore, and you need the client's help to do this, but that we use a lot of private investigative resources to understand our opponents.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to know what motivates them. And you have to know what motivates their lawyer. Is he being paid hourly? Is she being paid on a contingency? Does she have a dog in the fight? How's his business doing? Does he need this case to bill? Those kinds of things are important. And knowing your judge, you've got to know your judge. If you receive a lawsuit in the mail, it's going to have a number on it. It's going to say division something, or it's going to say courtroom something. If the lawyer you're hiring has not been in front of that judge, find another lawyer.
Which is really important, because you got to understand what makes the judge tick, what their background is, where they went to school, their specialty, the cases they've heard, and the interaction you've had, whether it's been positive or negative with that judge.
I'll give you an example. I've done so many non-compete cases in Johnson County since 1998, when I started in this town, that I can tell you which judges like them and which ones don't. And some judges just don't like non-competes.
How easy is it to change the judge?
It's impossible.
So whatever you're assigned, that's your judge.
Oh, in Johnson County, I thought you meant change your judge's mind.
Oh.
On something like a non-compete, if they've developed an opinion on it,
you're, that's it.
Yeah, you're probably not going
to. But I mean, if I see that, Hey, the judge that got assigned to my case is one that I know is they're going to probably issue an opinion that's different than what I want. Can I change judges? Is easier?
You can do it in Jackson County.
Okay.
You can't do it in Johnson County. Difference between the Kansas and Missouri rules. You get one change of judge in Jackson County. You need to be careful about how you do that.
Yeah.
But no, your judge is who you get. And so having a lawyer who can predict the judge's views on discrete legal issues in the case is critically important. I mean, it's just as much a relationship business as anything else. And if you spend time in front of those judges and you've developed a reputation of being honest and straight with them, you're going to get a better result.
So we've talked a lot about this process. We've talked a lot about getting sued. We've talked a lot about litigation, the process, what to expect if you haven't been through that before. I'd like to spend a little bit of time now talking about what are the strategies that clients can put in place to protect themselves from litigation. One of mine is the type of company that you set up. Is this a solo practitioner? Is it a partnership? Is it an LLC? Is it a C Corp? What are you setting up to protect yourself as a type of company?
Having some sort of organizational structure is better than having none. What I've found is that most clients are choosing a limited liability company or a corporation based on their growth plans and what the tax advice
from their CPA or accountant is. Yeah,
sure. That's the key.
Talk about ops agreements, I know, is another way to protect yourself. Talk about operations agreements. What are some of the good things that people do and mistakes?
Have one. Have one is a great thing. Not having an operating agreement for a limited liability company.
What percentage don't have ops agreements, do you think, out there? Those of you who don't have one, put a big pin mark on your left hand to remind you that you better call and get an ops agreement in place.
Our friend Pascal Henn is who you want to call for your operations.
She's phenomenal at that.
Yes, Pascal, so she can set your company up the right way.
I find it's about 50% that I visit with don't have an ops agreement or have one that's so old, it won't work.
It varies by business. So a lot of the cases we handle are companies that have one, two, three, four owners. A lot of them had worked for big corporations in the past. There were lots of former Sprint folks that go off and have an entrepreneurial spirit and start their business. They're pretty good about having operating agreements. The construction industry and the land development industry, they're rare. Lots of things are done on a handshake. Mm-hmm. And what people forget is a promise on a handshake is often enforceable. We do lots of handshake deals. You can enforce an oral contract. You cannot for the sale of land, for the guarantee of a loan, a marriage contract, the sale of goods for more than $500 under the Uniform Commercial Code. And basically anything else, you can probably enforce it if you have some evidence that it exists.
So what about trusts and wills? Wills don't really protect too much, do they? Mostly trusts are the what you want in order.
Irrevocable trusts, where control is truly relinquished, are a useful asset protection measure. Revocable trusts, where the person who owns the property really keeps owning it, don't provide that same level of protection. But trusts are frequently going to be named as defendants in cases, along with the individuals. So trusts are good. These organizational forms are good. But really, talking to a lawyer about your business and the risks of your business will allow you to protect yourself better than any form you're going to get off the internet.
What about non-disclosures and non-competes?
Some states have outlawed non-competes. California, they're not enforceable at all. There are some states that just don't like them. Kansas, you can still enforce non-competes. Missouri, you can still enforce non-competes and non-solicitation agreements. There's some statutory rules of thumb in Missouri. Mm-hmm. 2 years is sort of the limit.
Okay.
But Kansas is fairly aggressive for employers in being able to enforce restrictive covenants. It's a business decision. It depends on your industry. It depends what others in your industry are doing. I will tell you that I've seen a trend over the last 5 years, even unskilled employees being more savvy about what they mean, and being unwilling to sign them without a forgivable loan or some kind of bonus. I know in the financial industry, those forgivable loans are a great way to get people to sign non-compete, non-solicitation agreements. So it's a business decision, and then you have to stick with it. If you decide you're going to have them, you got to sue to enforce them, or don't have them.
The other piece of advice, whatever you sign, keep a copy of it, and don't keep a copy of it at work. Keep
great.
A copy of it at home, locked up, scan it in, put it in a lockbox somewhere. I can't tell you how many times I have clients come in that say, I've got this compensation issue or a non-compete. I don't know what I signed. I don't know where my copy is. and I'm going to have to ask my employer for it, but I don't want to ask them, so what do I do?
That's a very common problem, Brian. I'm not surprised you hear that a lot. Yes, keep a copy of any agreement you sign. And
even emails that change as things go along, those are binding as well, are they not, if you get an email from somebody?
They can be. Sure, they can be. Someone with authority might have the ability to revise the contract. A lot of these contracts say they can only be modified with the signatures of both parties, but not all. And so having those emails that maybe define terms or talk about the scope of the agreement are important to keep. All of that's going to be important. On your second question, the non-disclosure agreement, highly encourage those if you have any intellectual property that you need to protect. But it needs to be protectable intellectual property. If I can go find it on the internet, it shouldn't be subject to a non-disclosure agreement, or you're diluting the important stuff that you do need to protect.
Very great advice. It's been wonderful visiting with you today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate you being here. I hope it's been a great learning experience for those of you that have tuned in to this episode of Let's Make Work Optional. If somebody wants to contact you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Best way to get a hold of me is by email. My email address is mgeiger, mgeiger, at geiger, geiger, prell, prell.com. The Prell is Ben Prell, my partner. Wonderful partner, smart man, great attention to detail, and definitely there would be no Geiger Prell without Ben. So either of us would be happy to help you. Again, that's mgeiger at geigerprell.com. I'd love to hear from anybody that has a question.
Absolutely. They can visit with you and get some guidance on what to do to protect themselves, to try and keep out of hot water, or to protect themselves for when they are going to have a legal dispute. And if you're in business, you're going to have one at some point. It's just part of being in business.
It is, Brian. It is.
The reference material I've used for today's podcast was from AES Nation and CEG Worldwide. Thanks for listening to Let's Make Work Optional from True Wealth & Company. I'm your host, Brian Sarf. With me this week has been Matt Geiger, business trial attorney. We'll be back next Tuesday morning at 5 a.m. Be sure to spread the word about this podcast to your friends and family, and don't keep us a secret. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, connect with us on LinkedIn, and don't ever forget, invest wisely, save early. Let's make work optional.
You've been listening to Let's Make Work Optional from True Wealth & Company. Visit us online at retirewithtrue.com or call 913-653-TRUE. That's 913-653-8783. All matters discussed during this program are for informational purposes only. This podcast in no way shall be construed as a solicitation to sell securities or advisory services to residents in any other state than Kansas or where otherwise prohibited. Topics should be discussed with your advisor prior to implementation. Advisory and insurance services offered through True Wealth & Company, LLC, a registered investment advisor in the state of Kansas.